body. Now, first of all, before we get to our main interview today, I'd just like to talk about the fact that Imaginary Sandwich Bar is coming back to your radios or smart speakers or however you listen. And the new series is scheduled to be transmitted in January. Recordings will be in December this year. But before that happens, and you can apply for tickets to come to those recordings, but before that happens, if you want to get a preview, I am doing work in progress shows at a place called the Museum of Comedy, which is in sort of Bloomsbury in central London. It's a lovely little 70-seater venue. And what I'm going to do is I will do two whole sandwich bar shows each night. I mean, obviously in, you know, they're in
rawish
form. But nevertheless, we'll do them as if you are at a recording of Sandwich Bar. Those dates are the 16th, 17th, 29th, 30th of November and 1st of December. Tickets to go, even though it's a fair way away, tickets are going fairly rapidly. But I think I would love it. I mean, particularly, I think the first one, the 16th, is a little bit slow. So I would love it if you could come, if any fans want to come. Obviously, I will be around afterwards in the bar. I will sign stuff. I will do selfies. It would be nice to talk to you. It's a sort of place where that kind of interaction is fine.
How many episodes are going to be in the new series, Alexi?
Four.
That's four?
The same. Yeah, it's always the same. It's only
so if they came to see four. Two nights in a row of the work in progress, they would potentially see the whole series.
See all the Sandwich Bar, yeah.
Wow. And in each night, you'll be doing half the series. That's awesome value for money.
It is unbelievable.
And you can go to museumofcomedy.com, click on what's on. And if you go down to November, you'll find Alexi's cute, cheeky little face there, his headshot.
Yep.
That's where you can buy your tickets. I will put a link in the description of the podcast as well. Okay.
Yes. It'd just be really nice. Just be nice to have it, you know, full ahead of time and, with fans, really.
It helps the series, doesn't it? If you have a big audience there, you really get proper feedback for which bits work, which bits don't.
Find which works, which don't, you know. Also, I deviate from, I mean, I do it in the recordings as well, but I will deviate from the script, as it were, while I'm
I've seen it in my own eyes. I've seen you, like, something sparks in your head and you go, oh, and you follow a train of thought, don't you?
Yeah.
Do those bits ever make it into the final show?
Sometimes, I think, yeah. It's hard to know. I can't remember, really. Sometimes, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so go to museumofcomedy.com.
Yeah, I would really like it if...
support if Alexi.
Yeah. Also, last night I was at a dinner for a charity that I support, that I'm a donor to, which is Medical Aid for Palestinians. And, you know, what can you say? But they have made a short little film about their work. And I will send the link and you can also watch that. And I would love it if you could also find it in your heart. If you're looking for a charity to support, then you couldn't do better than MAP. You know, that it was, the stuff that they were doing was difficult enough before October the 7th. It is now more profoundly difficult, but it's about simple human. MAP is about simple human decency versus human awfulness.
That's map.org.uk. map.org.uk, and we'll put a link to the video in the description as well.
Yep. So work in progress shows and MAP film. So
shall we
now proceed to the body of our
shall we not we won't plug patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast this episode.
We mustn't do that.
We're not going to plug patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast this episode because we'd love you to visit Medical Aid for Palestinians.
Yeah, instead, or you can do both.
And buy your ticket for Alexi's work in progress.
Yeah, do that.
So please
what a
don't
great Christmas gift.
Don't visit patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast.
No, do not.
There's other ways to support. Oh man, yeah, because yeah, things again. We'll talk about Palestine at the end again, right. Shall we? We'll do a depressing outro again.
yeah, what everybody. Leave them watching.
Episode 56 of the AlexisL podcast. What's going
on? Yes, and this is a scoop that you obtained. Mm-hmm. It is Ben McIntyre talking about his new book, The Siege, which is about the siege of the Iranian embassy in 1980. I mean, one thing listening to your edit of the show, I mean, I think that, I mean, my technique, I mean, I do this in both, I do it more in Strangers on a Train, my Radio 4 series, but I also do it in this in that I tend to, you know, the guest is there to put their point of view. It's not an interrogation, and therefore I, you know, don't necessarily wear our views diverge. I don't necessarily press them too hard. I think that just listening, I think Ben has a more benign, given who he is and, you know, where he's located, he has a more benign view of the security services.
I was wondering where you're going. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just listed that. I thought, well, I don't challenge him particularly in the body of the piece, but I don't think who he says the security services are, I don't believe that is essentially who they are. And I was thinking afterwards, he does sort of allude to it a bit, but, you know, for instance, that, you know, it's certainly true that, like, for instance, the Ariana Grande bomber, suicide bomber, and his family were connected, you know, had been shipped in and out of Libya by MI6. And that is just something that springs to mind off the top of my head.
Really?
The nature. I think so. Or maybe we should check that before we put it out. But I think it's pretty well known that he was a security services stooge, or had been, you know.
Well, MI5 did apologize for not stopping that bombing. They, you know, that's established news.
Yes.
But yeah, look,
but
just
also because
Alexei...
I don't think this is just, you know, internet conspiracy theory stuff, that I think that they were smuggled in, or I don't know. Listeners should get the details, but I think that they had been brought in and out of Libya, him and some of his father, I think, by and his
yeah,
brother.
Yeah, and MI5 had the chance to stop him coming here from Libya. This is according to BBC, a BBC article. So, point being, just because Alexei has someone on the show and doesn't necessarily challenge them directly doesn't mean he's in agreement. And I'm glad that you brought that up.
You'd notice.
And
that.
You're right to say Ben does allude to it as well. He does say, you know, they don't always succeed, and like sometimes their intentions aren't clear and cut.
But, no. But I do feel compelled to add my own caveat to that. But on the other, you know, I think, you know, I guess, as I say, it's not an interrogation. A guest is on to, by and large, talk about, you know, what they want to talk about. But yeah, I would demur from what he thinks the security services are. Should we get to it?
We got a bit derailed there, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, Ben is here to talk about his book about the Iranian embassy. We weren't very clear about that. Iranian embassy siege in 1980. There's little surprises there, which we'll save for the interview.
Yeah.
Thank you. And we're live, studio.
Well, today we have Ben McIntyre, noted author, and he is here to talk about his latest book. And I sound like a Radio 4, proper Radio 4 arts person, I think. It's an unusual position for me to be in. Ben's here to talk about his new book. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
Hi. this book is of particular interest to Lyle, and we'll get to that at some point. But first of all, I'd like to, it'd be interesting. I've followed your career from a distance, and it's particularly as a fan of military history myself and World War, particularly history of World War II. I've followed your books, seen the movies, and so on and so forth. So I suppose I would just like to. I mean, and also I think your kind of career trajectory. So I guess we just start at the start, really, and tell us how you became a best-selling author. Right?
Oh, what a nice intro. well, I didn't start by becoming a best-selling author. I read a lot of books that are very forgotten now. But I was a journalist for years, so I was a foreign correspondent in New York and Paris and then Washington. Not exactly hardship postings, but completely lovely places to be. And then I started writing books about 25 years ago, and I got sort of drawn.
Who were you a journalist for? Was it the BBC?
I worked for the Times, and I'm still
Times,
a columnist.
All right, okay.
Times. So that's been my professional home for 35 years. Mm-hmm. So I was trained as a journalist, but in a way, a lot of my books have kind of journalistic elements to them. They are kind of reporting or trying to get as close to the truth as you can with a kind of limited amount of material. But I guess my sort of world changed a lot when I started writing about espionage, and when I was at university, I was actually tapped up by MI6, and so I had a kind of brief experience of that world. Disastrous, really. I was useless at it, but I found
you actually went and you. Yeah, well, I don't know how much you can say, but
interviews and so on.
Yeah,
and it was they very quickly worked out that, as I've just demonstrated, I wouldn't make a good spy because I can't keep a secret. But I was fascinated by that world, and then about 15 years ago, a little more actually, I wrote a book called Agent Zigzag, which was about a professional criminal called Eddie Chapman, who had been recruited by German intelligence in the Second World War. And they called him Zigzag because they could never be sure whose side he was on, because he was trained by the Germans and then parachuted into Britain. And his story was incredibly exciting, and he kept sort of swapping sides, really. And actually, he ended up as the crime correspondent of the Daily Telegraph, which I wrote. But so his story kind of sent me into the world of espionage, and I've been writing about espionage and military stuff, usually sort of secret military stuff, ever since. I mean, in a way, the immediate precursor to this book, although it's not chronologically the precursor, was a book about the wartime SAS, SAS Rogue Heroes, that was called, which was done with the authorization of the SAS. So I had full access to their wartime archive, which was absolutely fascinating because that had been kept pretty much secret up until that point.
I mean, I suppose, what do you feel about the security services? I mean, I think, as somebody from the left, we tend to see them as a kind of monolithic, I think, force for, well, not for good necessarily, but I think it's perhaps more complex than that. And certainly I don't know if I've been directly friends with active agents, but I've certainly known people who've had family members who are agents, and they're kind of, I mean, I think the people who are drawn to that world are very complicated people, and their motives are very complicated. I don't know.
I think that's absolutely right, Alexei, and that's one of the reasons why I love writing about them, is that they are not straightforward, one-dimensional, black and white people. Espionage is an extremely complicated, morally fraught, difficult situation. And, you know, the security service, of course, when one talks about the security service, one is talking about MI5. We're talking about the people who...
I always get which one's foreign and which one's domestic. But I always get it mixed up.
MI6 is foreign. MI6 is agents recruited abroad by British intelligence to spy on their own country.
Right.
That's what MI6 does.
So it'd be MI5 that comes for me.
MI5 comes from you, Alex. They've got a dossier so fat, they don't even know where to begin.
I know I've got a special branch file, but do you think I'll have an MI5 file as well?
Well, I don't know what you do in your private time, Alex. So you might do, but the truth is MI5 are the people who stop you from being blown up in your bed.
I mean, right.
They are, which doesn't mean they always do it well, doesn't mean they're always brilliant at it, but they are the security service. They are here to counter threats to this country. I sound like I'm a shill for MI5. I'm not really, because I realize that, you know, they are all security services are open to dangerous manipulation and excess. And who is an enemy perceived as an internal enemy today may not be an enemy tomorrow. But I mean, the modern MI5 is particularly preoccupied with cyber threats from China, personal threats from Russia, Iranian dissidents, and, you know, remnants of Irish violent Irish republicanism. They're not really spying on you and me. They have to do that in order to get to the people they need to get to. But they are what they say. They're a security service. They are extremely effective policemen, if you like. But it's complicated. But, you know, that was never always the case. You know, the Gestapo would have described itself as a security service as well. So, you know, this is not a simple one-size-fits-all category. And, you know, different intelligence services behave in different ways at different times. So in a way, that's why I love it. It's, you know, it allows me to write about the sort of stories that novelists usually commandeer. So I get to write about loyalty and love and betrayal and adventure and romance, but it's all true, you know,
because
those intelligence service files are astonishingly rich in the elements of betrayal and disloyalty that are central to all forms of espionage. You know, MI6, its job is to persuade foreign people to break the laws of their own country. There's disloyalty absolutely woven into the whole operation.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose Agent Ziggs, that was an exemplary piece of intelligence, wasn't it? In the British intelligence rolled up all German agents in Britain and then got them to feed back false information to the Germans, didn't they?
It was an astonishing feat. It would have been absolutely impossible without Bletchley Park. The breaking of the Enigma code enabled MI5 to know ahead of time what German intelligence was planning to do. So when the Germans were sending in agents to this country, including Eddie Chapman, who'd been recruited by German intelligence, they knew when they were coming. So they were able to intercept them.
Right.
They were able to make a choice between either executing them. 14 of them were executed, the so-called unlucky 14. Mm-hmm. Always rather an understatement, really. They were shot by a firing squad in the Tower of London. Or they were turned. They were used, and their wirelesses and whatever other method of communication they had with the Abwehr, the German intelligence service, was then manipulated by British intelligence. Or they were kept in prison, and they were impersonated. MI5, which was a brilliant operation, would pretend to be the agent that had been dropped in or parachuted in. And at one point, they believed that they had total control of the German intelligence system in this country. They believed they controlled the whole thing until they had a terrible shock when they realized that one agent had got through who went by the unimprovable name of Engelbertus Fucken. And his body was found in a disused bomb shelter in Cambridge. And no one has ever been able to work out how Engelbertus Fucken got into the country without being caught.
I think we found the episode title.
And also Operation Mincemeat, of course, is one of your...
Well, that again, it's a story that would be impossible to write if MI5 had not released, declassified its archives. I mean, we are...
Because there was a film, wasn't there, The Man Who Never Was in the...
The Man Who Never Was, while it's a wonderful film, is nonetheless more or less fantasy. I mean, it's...
Right.
It's sort of much of it is completely invented. But we're funny about secrecy in this country. We we regard it as being dangerous, and people who keep secrets as somehow are working against us. Actually, secrecy is really important. You need to have secrecy or you can't function as a state. I would never have been able to write Operation Mincemeat if MI5 had not declassified its MI5 files.
Mm-hmm.
They're just wonderful. I mean, they're extraordinary. They tell you minute by minute how this mad operation was mounted. It was the one where they got a dead body and used it to try and successfully to pass false information by floating it off the coast of Spain into the hands of a particularly brutal German spy who was operating there. And they gave him a completely false identity, this character. Actually, he was a homeless man from Wales, but they turned him into Major William Martin of the Royal Marines and gave him a completely false identity and shipped him ashore. And it was an astonishingly successful. In fact, it was so successful that the makers of it got panicked at one point because they didn't really believe it was ever going to work.
Yeah, because they're taking a hell of a chance just floating a body from a submarine and hoping that it will be picked up, and then that information will be passed on to the
And the danger is
Abwehr.
The danger is if the Abwehr rumbled it. So the idea was to divert German attention from the looming assault on Sicily and try and persuade them that the attack was coming in Greece and Sardinia. Now, the danger was that if the Germans rumbled the ruse, worked out that this was false information being fed to it, they would read it backwards. And they would therefore realize that, in fact, instead of it not being Sicily, it was going to be Sicily.
Yeah.
It would reinforce Sicily, and thousands of people would potentially be killed as they went ashore. So it was an enormously high-stakes gamble, which is why they sort of panicked halfway through. The only person who didn't panic at all was Churchill. Churchill said, if this doesn't work, we was just float him again, he said.
So I suppose, well, I don't know. I mean, do you want to move on to your latest book or?
Sure.
Okay.
This one, in a way, leads on from the SAS Rogue Hero story. It's a story I've wanted to write for years. And it's the story of the Iranian embassy siege in 1980. When half a dozen armed Arab gunmen with machine guns and grenades attacked the Iranian embassy in London and took it over and took 26 hostages for a week or 6 days. And it's a fascinating story. I was a little boy when this happened, and I was watching the snooker final with my dad, and it was Hurricane Higgins against Cliff Thorburn, and it was coming down to the two final frames, and suddenly they cut away. It was a bank holiday Monday, and they cut away from the snooker to live footage of SAS soldiers in balaclava helmets sailing down the outside of the embassy and blowing up the windows. And it had a real effect on me. I mean, I wasn't alone. There were 14 million people watching the snooker at that point.
Right.
They were enraged to be moved to the other channel, to the live footage. But it's one of the reasons I think why I became a journalist, actually, was that I thought that was so extraordinary to be able to watch a news event of that kind of drama taking place.
Yeah.
None of us had ever seen anything like that before.
No, well, just my personal experience, we lived in on the 12th floor of a tower block in Fulham at the time, and I saw a plume of smoke going up.
Wow.
I said to Linda, they've gone in.
Well, you were following it closer than I was, Alexei.
Yeah.
I mean, I was only a little boy, so I hadn't really followed the siege itself that closely, and it's one of those stories that has became a legend almost immediately. It became part of British mythology, and it became, I mean, the way I inherited it was that it was rather a simple story of sort of British daring do, you know, tough SAS blokes go in and beat the baddies and save the hostages. And of course, that is partly true. Like all myths, has an element of truth to it. But the real story is so much more complicated and so much more interesting. So I think if you ask the average person in the street, what was the Iranian embassy siege about? Most people would say, well, it was Iran, so it was Islamic fundamentalists.
Yes.
The truth is that's not right at all.
No.
I mean, the Iranian Revolution had just taken place in 1979. These were Arabs from Iran who were fighting for political rights as a minority within Iran. They were
Sunnis, yeah.
You know, they were trying to make I mean, it was a brutal and violent statement. I'm not pretending that they were, you know, good people, although they were interesting people. They were, you know, they were highly educated. The leader spoke three different languages, each of them extremely well. You know, these were not sort of cardboard cutout, you know, villains. The leader, Tawfiq al-Rashidi, had a very clear political plan. He didn't want to kill anyone.
And also they were in and are presumably an oppressed minority within Iran.
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, they had taken part in the revolution. They'd supported the revolution, and they believed quite genuinely that they would be granted, that the Ayatollah would grant them political rights as a result. On the contrary, what happened was, as soon as the Ayatollah and his mullahs were in power, they clamped down on the Arab minority. And there was an appalling bloodbath in southwest Khuzestan, where these guys came from, and they all lost family members. I mean, the leader's brother, a man called Najid, was captured by the Iranian security services, tortured, and then murdered. And that is that, you know, those are the motivations, the sorts of motivations. That's how you make a terrorist. How do you make a man kill? You kill the thing that he loves. And we see that all over the Middle East now. It's a very simple way to turn somebody to extreme violence. And I'm not just I'm not saying it exculpates it at all. There are hidden stories here, and that goes for everybody involved, not just the gunmen, the hostages, the policemen, the politicians, and the SAS. These are not – nobody is a hero and nobody is a villain in this world, and things go wrong, and a lot went wrong inside that embassy.
Yeah, so, I mean, tell us about that, I guess. I mean, so.
Well, the first thing that happened was they attacked the embassy and they burst in through the front door. And the policeman who was on guard there, a man called Trevor Locke, PC Trevor Locke, who was the diplomatic protection officer there, still, I'm delighted to say, very much with us and has been a great help on this story. He's a wonderful man. He's not a Sweeney-type cop. He's a Dixon of Dot Green cop.
Yes.
Is what he himself would say. He said he joined the police to help old ladies cross the road. That was what he was supposed to do. And the gunman attacked the embassy. He had a gun on him, which he did not pull. The story would have been completely different.
Yes.
That gun on him secretly for the next 6 days. They bundled into the embassy, 26 people. Were taken captive. Most of them were Iranians. Some of them were senior diplomats, appointees of the Ayatollah. These were people who believed in the fundamentalist mission of the Ayatollah. There were several British citizens.
We should at this point, I suppose, throw to our co-host here. One of the hostages was a Syrian journalist called Mustafa Karkouti.
Daddy.
The father of young Talal Karkouti here, and an old friend of mine from my student days, really. So,
yeah, it's fascinating listening to you talk, and from what I've read so far in the book, because this is a story I've grown up with. My dad was in there, and as a hostage, I always need to specify that, because this is just a story that surrounded me growing up, and every year there would be hostage reunions at my house, and sometimes the SAS blokes would show up, and I'm very much familiar with the emotional story, the human story, and in particular my dad's point of view of what happened in there. And then when you talk about the actual like biographical facts of the gunman, and even the way you describe Trevor, it's not a way that I'm familiar with the story, you know. And even reading your book, and it was so. It's still as if I'm hearing it for the first time, because I'm hearing facts that I might have heard once or twice here or there. But the thing that is so ingrained in my psyche is the emotional impact and the lifelong PTSD that my dad had from this whole thing.
I mean, Mustafa Karkouti, I don't need to tell you this, Tara. I'm sure I don't need to tell you, Alexei, is an absolutely pivotal figure in this story. I mean, you will tell his past much better than I will, but he was a Syrian-born journalist. He was the only person in the embassy able to speak the three principal languages in which this story takes place: English, Arabic, and Farsi. I mean, his Farsi was not brilliant. I think that's right to say.
Yeah.
But he spoke enough. So he became the key interlocutor in this story. It's the person who is dealing with the police negotiators, the person who is dealing with the Arab gunman inside, is Mustafa Karkouti, your old friend, Alexei, and your father, Talal. And I mean, this story, I very early on in the research, Talal's family very kindly let me read Mustafa's own account of what had happened inside that embassy. And it's an astonishing document. It's a proper first-person account of what it felt like for him. And it contained, for me, some astonishing revelations. It deserves to be published in its own right. I mean, it is a remarkable piece. And it's not the only one, actually. I mean, one of the bizarre things about this story is it's 1980, so everybody is writing everything down.
Yeah.
It's not like today where we all think we're all keeping a record. We're not. But then they were. And there, I have four unpublished accounts from people who were involved in this story. One policeman who kept a diary, the senior policeman, John Dello, the man who organized Operation Nimrod, who's never been revealed before, who also kept a diary, Hector Gullen. Then there's Mustafa's own astonishing account, and Sim Harris, another of the hostages. So there's a huge amount of material in there. But I mean, there's an argument to be made that without Mustafa in there, this story could have ended really brutally. I mean, it would have ended in the way these things normally end, not normally, but can end, with total miscommunication between the various parties.
Mustafa
was the one who enabled these people to keep talking to each other.
So, take us through carry on with the timeline then, sort of thing, I think.
Well, so the first day, and let me just also say there were two other key journalists in there. One is a man called Sim Harris. Again, I'm delighted to say still with us, who was a BBC.
Yeah, we know Sim, yeah.
And the other was a man called Chris Kramer, who was a BBC producer, alas, no longer around. And then the other British citizen was a man called Ron Morris, who was the sort of major domo in the operation. He was a sort of caretaker, and he was the longest serving employee. Many of the captives were women whose stories have never been told before.
Yes, that's something
Iranian. Women, they were, as the times were, they were secretaries and clerks. They were not diplomats, but they also played an absolutely vital role in what happened. So the gunman's intentions were to force the Iranian government to release political prisoners, 91 of them, 91 Arabs held in Tehran, to get their message out to the world. So there was a media intention here. They wanted the world to listen to them, to understand their position. Then they expected to be given a plane, and then they would fly home. That was the plan. Now, it sounds unbelievably naive that this was ever going to happen. The truth is, it was not without precedent. In the Arab world, particularly, Carlos the Jackal, a character who may be familiar to you, had pulled off a stunt like this against the OPEC oil ministers in 1975. This had happened. You know, governments were often prepared to negotiate over hostages, and sometimes even the British government was prepared to allow people of violence to fly home. Under Edward Heath, a particular Palestinian gunwoman called Leila Khaled had hijacked a plane, but then she had been released and allowed to fly home back to, she's still around.
Yes.
So they weren't. It's not like they were mad. They had a plan. I mean,
right.
What nobody knows, and what was in fact revealed by Mustafa's document, is that the entire plot, the entire plan, had been cooked up by Saddam Hussein. This was an Iraqi organized, financed armed operation, and this was Saddam Hussein's way of destabilizing Iran. This was the first battle, if you like, in the Iran-Iraq war. And it was
at the time when Saddam was an ally of ours.
Sort of ally. But so it's complicated. And the person who actually masterminded it was a man called Abu Nidal, who was then the most wanted terrorist in the world. He was responsible for killing hundreds of people. And he was working at that point as a sort of freelance advisor to Saddam Hussein. He was living in Baghdad. I mean, he was a man of extreme violence, but he's the person who organized all this. That's never been revealed before.
This
was an international plot. So
but you, you mentioned Said earlier you were describing the gunmen as intelligent and put together, but the story I've always heard is that, maybe apart from their leader, is that they were just kids and they were naive and they were kind of shaky and dangerous in their unpredictability.
That is true of some of them. I mean, they were different characters. They really were. So if you like, and it's a bit of a sort of obvious thing to do, you can divide them up. I mean, Tawfiq al-Rashidi was highly intelligent. He knew what he was doing. He'd been properly briefed. He spoke very good English. He came from a sort of educated background. So he, if you like, is the kind of officer class. Then there were two other guys who were kind of NCOs, if you like. They were clever. They were organized. They knew what they were doing, but they weren't educated. But they were committed to the cause. And then the remaining three, two of them were manipulated, really. They were not of high intelligence. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Their families had been brutalized. They had been brutalized. They'd lost people. They were easy meat, if you like, to be used in an operation like that. And the final one was really a child. I mean, he had no real idea what he was doing. He believed them when they said, "Oh, they'll get out." And one of them was clearly highly mentally unstable. Not the youngest of them, one of the others. He was as often people are in them. People don't tell you this, but there is a high incidence of mental illness associated with terrorist acts. Those are
certainly
Are the people that the manipulators of terrorism target, because they can be manipulated, and that is as true of this story as it is of any other.
Yeah,
my dad always said that about terrorism and that they. Who would drive themselves to go and blow themselves up for a cause? You've got to be particularly mentally. And you mentioned Carlos the Jackal earlier. My dad had a fist fight with him back in the day because my dad's girlfriend at the time was friends with Carlos, and they were all, pro-Palestinian activists. And Carlos was in London, and him and my dad's girlfriend invited Carlos around for supper. This is before the big incident that made him infamous. But my dad disagreed with Carlos's really extreme methods and motivation. And like they both agreed on the same cause, but my dad thought he was far too extreme in what he wanted to do. And he ended up fighting him. And then when the big, incident happened with Carlos the Jackal, my dad's house ended up getting raided by the police because they knew he'd spent a night there. And
raised a very interesting point, which again, you may know, but most do not, which is that because of your father's associations with the Palestinian cause, because he had trained in Palestinian camps, because he had friends on that side of the story, because he had met Carlos the Jackal, when it emerged that Mustafa Karkouti was inside that building, the police understandably jumped to a fairly obvious conclusion. They thought he must be in on it.
Oh, shoot.
So
no
from
way.
The beginning, they suspect there is an MI5 file on your father because once it transpired that he was inside, what the hell was an Arab journalist doing in there at that point? And what's more, and your father was very concerned about this. I know this because he wrote it down. When he began to kind of interpret for the police what the Arab gunman wanted, he began using the first person plural. At points, he said "we." That sent off huge alarm bells inside.
But he was just translating.
He was translating. He wasn't. He wasn't espousing their cause. He was very worried that the police might think he was espousing their cause. He was in a really difficult position because he knew, and he, as you know, he had another passport too. And he was extremely worried that the MI5 might come calling and find that and begin to think that he must have been part of the plot. Obviously, he wasn't. He played a brilliant role in kind of trying to keep the sides talking to each other. But at the time, the police were dead worried, and so was MI5.
It's fascinating. Yeah. So, it always seemed to me that this siege, certainly in the UK, marked a kind of turning point in so many different ways. That technologically, that a siege should be broadcast live. And why was that? Is that just because press cameras were a time to get set up outside the embassy?
Yes, it was partly just a practical thing that the technology was available.
There'd be big, bulky outside broadcast cameras, presumably linking back to a van or something.
On sort of gantries and places on these cherry pickers looking down on the embassy. I mean, you wouldn't be allowed to do that because actually they were within range. I mean, they could have been picked off by the gunman and you'd never be allowed to do it today. So they had a kind of, I mean, quite literally, they had a bird's eye view. ITN brilliantly and completely sort of wickedly had smuggled a camera into the back of the building, some of the flats behind, and was secretly filming footage. The police didn't even know they were there when it was happened. And this was a huge security problem because if the terrorists had been watching television inside the embassy, they would have realized what was happening and they could have prepared for it. There was a real fear that might happen. The truth is two things had happened. One is, the terrorists never thought to turn on the telly. And the second is that, in fact, MI5 had snipped the cables. They'd already cut them off. The only other group, this always makes me laugh, of people in the entire country who were not watching this on television were the Cobra Committee in Whitehall, being chaired by Willie Whitelaw. Although there were televisions around the room, no one thought to turn them on. So really the only people in Britain who were making the final decision about what should happen were the people who weren't watching it. They were having it relayed by sort of sound via Special Forces leader Peter de la Billière. So that shows you just how new the technology was, that the leaders of this country, the top officials, never thought that it was possible. Jesus. They crossed their mind that it might be broadcast live. They weren't watching snooker, so they didn't know, like you and me.
The other thing is, if you're a weapons nut, the other thing is it's the first time that the Heckler & Koch MP5 was brought to our attention.
That's exactly
right. And then later went on to feature in many, many movies, I think probably starting with the Bruce Willis film.
Yeah, this was the SAS weapon of choice. This was what they used. They had two different versions. They had a sort of silenced version and a non-silenced version. But, of course, this is the other thing that people don't really know, is that the SAS had been training for this moment for many, many years, secretly at Hereford headquarters since 1972, a special projects team was always on standby to deal with a hostage situation, to deal with a terrorist situation. They didn't know it would be in an embassy. They thought it might be in any number of different places. But since the Munich Olympic massacre of 1972, the government had put in place provision for the military to take over, namely the SAS, to take over when the civilian authority could not cope.
And that was a step change as well, wasn't it? That the Munich massacre was different elements of the German police, and you can see that they're armed with, like, rifles. And
they made a complete cock-up of it. I mean, they got it completely wrong.
That's
why, you know, so many people died in that appalling situation.
Yeah.
You know, the government at the time in this country very sensibly actually said, we have to be ready for this.
Right.
We have something ready to do it. And the Iranian embassy siege, you talk about historical turning points, is the first time in the history of mainland Britain, in modern 20th century history, that civilian authority was surrendered to the military.
Yes.
For 11 minutes, control of that situation was handed over to the SAS. It had never happened before. And it, you know, the historical significance of that going forward is very great. I mean, Thatcher had only been in power for a year by this point. Her hold on power was not very strong. Nobody really knew who she was. Well, they did, but they didn't know enough about her. Had this assault gone the other way, Thatcher would have been in deep, deep trouble. And the SAS itself would probably have been disbanded. I mean, they were called to be disbanded anyway. So the stakes were pretty high.
Wow.
And ever afterwards, Thatcher used this event as her calling card. I mean, I don't know if you recall, but whenever she did something particularly tough, the cartoonists would picture Thatcher in SAS gear and balaclava helmet, sort of going down, abseiling down the outside of Westminster. So it became, you know, the SAS became her kind of army, and she was forever posing with them, you know, these are my guys. And you can argue that, you know, her incredibly robust approach to the Falklands that came up pretty soon afterwards was partly informed by what had happened. The SAS played a key part in the Falklands. Her attitude towards terrorism, you know, she felt that this event vindicated her stance never to negotiate with terrorists. Now we can argue whether that worked, but that is what became British policy, and much of that was founded on the success of Operation Nimrod, the assault on the Iranian embassy.
So, I mean, take us through further through the timeline then.
Inside the embassy, it ebbs and flows. There are moments when the hostages believe that they're getting on very well with the gunman. There is a certain amount of Stockholm syndrome going on inside there, a phrase which I'm sure your listeners will be aware of, where a certain affinity begins to develop between the hostages and gunmen. It happens in most hostage situations. There is the flip side of Stockholm syndrome is something called Lima syndrome, which happened, which is named after a terrorist event that took place in Lima when terrorists attacked the Japanese embassy there and took hostages. Lima syndrome is when the gunmen develop sympathy for their hostages.
Right.
The way around. So and there is lots of evidence that this was beginning to happen inside the embassy, that there are certain, what happens is that the gunmen and the hostages begin to find common cause and begin to blame the police for the situation that they are in. And Sim Harris will tell you this, that Mustafa himself became very frustrated with what they perceived as the slowness with which the police were. The fact is, the police had very little to negotiate with. I mean, Thatcher had made it absolutely clear that these guys were not coming out. There were not going to be Arab ambassadors sent to him to negotiate with them. They were going to be tried under British law. They were not going to climb into an aeroplane and fly home, which left the police with very little to talk about. They could talk about food. They could talk about cigarettes. They could talk about arranging a certain amount of media contact for the gunmen inside, limited, but they did in fact in the end broadcast the statement that the gunmen wanted. But in the end, the gunmen were not going to get what they wanted. If you talk to the psychiatrist, a man called John Gunn, who was brought in by the police to help them with negotiations, he believes that if the negotiations had been allowed to continue for even another 24 hours, that the gunmen would have given up. They would have laid down their guns and walked out.
And that, again, would not necessarily have been what Thatcher wanted. I mean, do you think,
I don't know. I don't think she wanted a shootout. I think she, I think she felt she had little choice.
Mm.
Even the SAS was warning her there will be 40% casualties. If we go through on this, a lot of people are going to die and a lot of people are going to be killed. So in a way, whatever you think about Thatcher, her decision was a bold one. She decided that if one person was killed, one of the hostages was killed, that negotiations could continue. But she ruled with advice that if two were killed, that was evidence of a systematic pattern and they had to send in the SAS. And they believed.
What I gleaned, I remember from watching the documentary was that was certainly one of them was very pro regime. Iranian regime and was very aggressive towards the terrorists. Is that right?
That is correct. So this is a man called Abbas Lavassani who was a press officer there. He was an absolutely devoted follower of Khomeini. He was a sort of extreme Islamist, and moreover, again, this will only just now be revealed. He was actually an officer in the Revolutionary Guard.
Uh-huh.
He was part of the Ayatollah's Praetorian team, and he was a spy. He was there to spy on the other members of the embassy and make sure that they were sticking to the rules. So he was in a way as much of an extremist as any of the gunmen. And mm-hmm. perhaps inevitably, it came to a confrontation between he and the deputy leader of the gunmen, a man called Jassim. And when Jassim started writing anti-Ayatollah graffiti all over the walls of the embassy, Abbas Lavassani confronted him and said, if you want a martyr, I'm your martyr. Martyrdom is very deeply kind of embedded in the whole Shiite tradition. And that is what he became. I mean, when it became totally, the tension just reached a cracking point at the end. He was executed. He was taken downstairs and tied to the banisters and killed. Now, what made that complicated was that because MI5 and the police had got bugs inside the embassy, they could hear what was going on. They heard this gunfire taking place, but they couldn't be sure that anyone had been killed. And it wasn't for another 6 hours that they then heard another burst of gunfire. And minutes after that, the body of Abaslani was pitched onto the front doorstep. Now, the police had by that point heard two sets of gunfire and one body. And they believed that there must therefore be, they were wrong as it happened. They believed there must be two people who had been killed. And that is the moment, fatefully, that John Dello, the police commissioner, relayed to Willie Whitelaw in the Home Office, said, "We believe there are two people. We believe we've crossed the red line here. What do you want to do?" And Thatcher at that point was driving back from Chequers. And Willie Whitelaw managed to contact her on the radio telephone. And from a lay-by north of High Wycombe, she gave authorization for this to go ahead. And it was a pretty high-stakes gamble. I mean, they genuinely thought it was going to get the terrorists, call them what you will, had threatened to blow up the entire building. The police had no evidence that they had not done that. I mean, there was a decent likelihood that the minute the first shot was fired, the whole thing, the whole building could go up in flames with everyone inside it. So this was a gamble, to put it.
And by then, Talal, your father was out, wasn't he?
Yeah, he fell ill the day before the SAS stormed in. Yeah. I think the stress got to him, you know, having spending half the time with his head out the window with a gun on the back of his head, translating and watching what Lavasani, like, hell-bent on becoming a martyr. I think at that moment, there was a moment he ripped his shirt open and said, "Make me a martyr, I'll be a martyr." And then my dad tackled him to the ground and slapped him in the face and said, "You're going to get us all fucking killed. Can you stop?"
Again, if Mustafa hadn't done that, God only knows what would have happened.
Yeah. And I think Dad managed to secretly publish in The Guardian from within the...
Well, he was...
From within... He telefax, what's the technology they had at the
telex.
Time?
There was still a telex operating in there, and the gunman did allow Mustafa and one other person to send one message out. And that it was actually to his home, to the Beirut. Arab language newspaper that he worked for. So yeah, I mean, they were able to get them out. I mean, Mustafa.
He didn't get something in the Guardian, or was that after the?
I think they copied it.
Tradition.
I think they ripped it off and pretended they'd got it. The Guardian actually though did manage to make direct contact. A man called John Hooper just by chance kept ringing the telex number. And astonishingly, it was picked up to his astonishment at the other end. And he got the world exclusive interview with the lead gunman. Soon after that, the police cut off all contact with it. They cut off all the telephones and all the telex machines. But your father was actually chosen by Taufik to be released. And it followed an all-night conversation that the two of them had had about Arab politics. And it is my belief, I haven't put this in the book, but I do think it is quite likely that Taufik wanted your father to survive because he believed that of all the people inside the embassy, your father was going to give them the fairest hearing, that he was likely to, when he told his, and this is true, he did. I mean, when he left the embassy, he was fair to all sides. And I think Taufik recognized that. And I think he was ill. I think he had also fallen ill, but he wasn't the only person who was ill inside there, and he probably wasn't the illest. But I think Taufik wanted him to go and wanted him to be, and it was partly a sort of an expression of goodwill. He wanted to keep the negotiations going at that point. The police had demanded the release of a hostage in return for broadcasting this statement. And your father was chosen as the person to do it. But I think it was also because as a fellow Arab, the gunmen believed that he would be fair to them.
So what happens next? So Thatcher gives the go-ahead for the building to be stormed. Yeah. And
the SAS, unbeknown to anybody but about three people in the police command, the SAS had been in the next door building from the beginning. A team of heavily armed SAS were ready to go right from the beginning. Within hours of the attack, they had moved into the College of General Practitioners, the GP's central headquarters, which just happened to be right next to the embassy. And they had a full plan in place, a thing called Operation Nimrod, which had been drawn up by a man called Hector, Major Hector Gullen, who was the commander of B Squadron of the SAS. And it's I've got it. I mean, it's an amazing document. And it is a six-pronged attack on the embassy from behind, from in front, and from above. And the idea was that one team would assault the front of the embassy by blowing out the armor-plated windows and then blasting their way inside. A second team would abseil down the back of the building to the second floor balcony, believing that that is where the hostages were being held. As it happened, they weren't. That was a failure of intelligence. They'd actually been moved to another room. At the same time, yet another team would explode a bomb in the middle of the embassy, lowering it down the central shaft of the embassy, which was above a kind of metal and glass atrium. They believed that the gunman, Taufik, if they could make sure that he was on the field telephone, so they put a special telephone in, which was also a bug, by the way. It had an eavesdropping device in it. They put a special telephone in with a measured cord so that they would know that if Taufik was speaking on that telephone, they had a pretty clear idea of where he was. Fact is, they got it wrong. They got it wrong because he wasn't where he was supposed to be. He'd actually wound the wire up to the first floor. So when this bomb went off, 2.5 tons of glass and metal went smashing down into the hallway. They believed they were going to be able to flatten him. They didn't. They missed him. He was in a different place. At the same time, another basement team was going to go in through the basement, and yet another team was going to come down through the interior shaft and go in through the internal windows. So it was going to be attacked literally from all sides. And the signal for this was the bomb going off in the central shaft.
Right.
It didn't go exactly according to plan. I'm not sure how much you want me to give away of what actually happened, but
you don't want to spoil everything. Let the readers.
The final assault, which takes up 1/3 of this book,
right,
covers 11 minutes.
Right,
so that's roughly the time it takes to cook a hard-boiled egg. so it's over very, very fast. But there are about 6 or 7 different gun battles taking place simultaneously around this building. And, you know, one of the incredibly lucky things I've had is that the Ministry of Defense allowed the surviving SAS soldiers, of whom there are roughly about a dozen left, to talk to me. And they've never talked before. They've never been allowed to speak openly about what happened. So I've been able to piece together those 11 minutes more or less. I mean, not second by second, but certainly minute by minute. I can tell the story of what was going on inside there.
All the terrorists are killed apart from one, is that right?
That's right.
Where's he now? Is he still in prison in Britain?
No, he's out. He's out. He served his time and is now at liberty. Yes, I mean, he survived by dint. And at this point, I have to make this point very clearly. The job of the SAS was not to kill terrorists. The job of the SAS was to liberate the hostages. Mm-hmm. If that required neutralizing, to use the word, the terrorists, that is what they were authorized to do. So it's a very important distinction, this, because there is one of the myths that persists about this is that somehow the SAS went in with a plan to execute people.
Yes.
It did not. Its job was to capture the hostage takers, if possible, but above all, to release the hostages. And in order of priority, you know, the policeman was to be got out first. This is the age we lived in then. The police were to be got out first, then the British citizens, then the foreigners who were non-Iranians, and then the Iranians, you know, the people of color. We would, if they had to be got out, well, fine, you know, I'm exaggerating, of course, but there was a list of priorities here. So the surviving gunman, a man called Fawzi Badawi Nejad, managed to survive really by hiding among the hostages. He was brought out among the women. He'd been guarding the women for most of the time. In fact, he had a sort of semi-flirtatious time with the women. The others all called him the ladies' man. He got on very well with the women. And there is a key moment at the end of this story when it looked as if some believe that the SAS, once they'd identified who Fawzi was, were preparing to drag him back inside. That's never been proven. But undoubtedly, some of the women hostages believed that was what was going to happen, and they gathered around him and said, "You know, do not, you know, he is our brother. He's been kind to us." So, I mean, Razi Nejad survived by the skin of his teeth. I mean, the truth is, of course, the SAS did not drag him back in and did not try to do that. But
you know, right,
it's a key moment. Yeah, yeah.
And while he was towards the end of his prison sentence, he wrote my dad a letter begging for forgiveness and apologizing. And my dad couldn't bring himself to forgive him. He wrote him back and said, "Thank you for apologizing. I understand your point of view. I understand you were young, blah, blah, and that you've served your time in prison, but I can't ever forgive you for what you put us through."
I think that's a very reasonable position on the part of your father. I mean, he wrote to pretty much everybody who was still alive, asking them to forgive him. I mean, forgiveness is a funny thing, isn't it? I don't really, in a way, I don't really understand what forgiveness is. I think it's one of those things that is often knocked around as a sort of easy way of making people at ease with their conscience. Fauzi is not at ease, I suspect, with his conscience. You know, he knows, but he was incredibly naive. He was, you know, he was 21, or I think he was 20. Yeah, I think he was just 21. He didn't know what he was doing. I'm not trying to make excuses for him. He should never have done that. But he was an idiot. I mean, I don't think he was a man.
Did you speak to him?
I've spoken to lots of people in this story, and I'm not really revealing who I've spoken to and who I haven't. But his is an interesting case. When we're 21, we all do really stupid things. And we think we're invulnerable. We think we're just going to live forever. And I do not want to pretend that what he did is excusable in any way. It really isn't. But he did serve his time. He served a very, very long sentence for being involved in a murderous terrorist plot. So you know, if justice works, justice works. But I completely understand why your father would feel that he couldn't.
I was always baffled by it because, I guess forgiveness is a concept of, we decide what the definition of it is when we do it. But I was like, so you accept his apology, you thank him for the apology, but you're not forgiving him. And I was always a bit baffled by what that actually meant. But I think it was just a boundary he set. It was just a red line, a line he drew in the sand. He couldn't. He couldn't go that far.
Yeah. No, I can understand. Let me ask you a question, Talal. I mean, I've talked to your sister and your mother about this, but I'd love your thought on it. I mean, how did your father cope with the experience, do you think?
For the following years, he was traumatized. Like, a loud noise would trigger him and he'd go run and hide in a cupboard, you know. If he was ever alone at home, you know, while my mum was out with the kids or something, he would hide behind doors until she returns. Like, he did not like being alone. He was not, you know, you mentioned he was trained in the Palestinian camps and stuff, but he wasn't a soldier ever.
No.
He was an activist and a supporter of certain campaigns, but he was never a soldier and he never advocated violence and never, he'd obviously, being from the Middle East at a certain time, he'd seen his fair share of shit, you know, you know, he'd been in prison and been beaten up in prison by the guards and tortured and stuff, but he'd never experienced something quite like that. Still, and later, you know, into his later years, so I was born 7 years after this, in his later years, he still didn't like gun violence. He didn't like it. He didn't like it being glorified in film and TV. It stayed with him forever. And I think it gave him, you know, he had chronic illness in his guts, in his tummy. And I think that was likely triggered by the stress of the situation because, you know, the timeline lines up quite well with that.
Yeah. Do you think he ever allowed himself a measure of pride, though? Because the truth is, Mustafa actually was a very, very... from what I know of him, what I've read about him, what I've written about him, was an extremely brave man. And And bravery comes in all sorts of unexpected ways. People find, and courage is a sort of odd thing, because we all like to think that we would be brave in the moment, that we do the right thing, that somehow we have whatever, what's that terrible thing, the right stuff in us. But nobody really knows. And Mustafa Karkuti was astonishingly brave in a way that he didn't have to be. I mean, not everybody in that building stepped up and said, okay, I will act as the interlocutor here. I will do what I can. And when he left the building, I mean, Sim Harris, for one, when Mustafa was released, said, we are in real trouble now. Without Mustafa, you know, we've lost our main person here. So I do hope that, although, I mean, obviously they were all traumatized horribly by this, that at some point in his life, he may have been able to look back and think, actually, when the chips were down, I did something pretty good. I did something pretty well.
We're all very proud of what he did in there. He wasn't, he wasn't a proud man. He was so humble, but he was very aware that he saved some lives in there. Sadly, you didn't get to meet him. Yeah, he passed away in 2020. And he would have loved to have been more involved in this book, but I'm so glad he had those writings. And yeah, he was never proud, and like he never puffed up his chest about it. It was always, he's just very pragmatic dude. He was a very pragmatic guy.
Well, he's one of the, I mean, it's a terribly overused word, but he is one of the unsung heroes of this story. I mean, yeah.
And you write about, your writing style is so good. If our listeners aren't aware, I was reading your introduction to my dad, and every character, when they come up in the story, you give them a nice passage and introduce their kind of background and bring them into the story. And it's so nicely done. It's like your writing style is like non-fictional novels almost, isn't it?
And well, that's sort of in a way,
it's really beautifully done. And when I got to the bit about my dad's introduction, it set me off. I started trembling, and it was really beautifully done. And just seeing his life kind of in one or two paragraphs, you kind of summarized it really nicely. And thanks for that, man.
Oh, well, thank you, Talal. I'm touched by that. I mean, these stories are, I don't know, I suppose if they do one thing, they ask a simple question, one that none of us can really answer without knowing. But, you know, these are people, these 26 hostages and the police and the gunmen and even the SAS were thrown into a situation none of them could have anticipated. Mm. No, but you can't train for this. You can't train to be a hostage. You can't, you know, no matter how much training you do as a hostage negotiator, you can't know what will happen. And I guess this book, like many of my books, I hope, asks a very simple question, which is, what would you do? I mean, I never express it openly that way, but which of the people in this story would you have been? Would you have sat tight? Would you have tried to get out? Would you have been the have-a-go hero? Would you have sat there for 6 days like Trevor Locke with a gun at your side, knowing that you might be able to change? I mean, which would you have been? Don't ask me that question, because I've written the book and I don't know the answer.
I suspect
that's what, in a way, I hope that's what these sort of stories do.
Right. Well, I think a good place to end. What's the book called?
It's called The Siege. Very simple.
Oh, right.
The Seed. So yeah, no. So, and it's been an absolute, you know, it's been a joy to write this book. I was nervous of it to begin with, because this is a story that many people, including many of the participants, believe they know back to front. But the truth is, they often, that's exactly how they do know it, is back to front.
Right.
You know, often some of the things that they believe to have happened simply did not happen.
You know,
and so there's been a certain amount of demythologizing in this story, which some will find difficult. Some of the things, even the participants have believed for many, many years, they will get a different picture. I'm not necessarily saying that mine is absolutely right, but they will definitely get a different picture from the one that they may have lived with.
Right.
Wow.
Extraordinary. Well, thank you very much, Ben. This will make an amazing piece of whatever podcasting, I suppose, whatever we call this thing that this is, I think it'll be. We specialize in either comedians or dour Marxist theoreticians. So,
I'm afraid neither of those involved in this story. It's been a great pleasure, guys. Thank you.
No, it's been extraordinary. It's been amazing. The whole hour has been yeah.
Thank you so much.
For me. Thank you, Ben. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you to Lau for arranging this as well. Shukran.
Yeah. Hear, hear. And thank you, Mustafa Kakuti, your dad.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't stop.
Much missed.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, everyone.
And actually, while I was listening to your edit of that, Linda was listening to it as well, and she said how interesting it was. And she usually avoids our podcast. So, she was very taken by this. I thought, point out that the 12-4 flat I lived in Fulham in 1980 was a council flat. I wasn't living in some luxury penthouse in. There's a 12th floor of a council block in Fulham that was, because it had been built on this system where the walls were just piled loosely on top of each other. Your
socialist credentials are secure,
yeah,
sir.
Yeah, and also, I also just thinking, you're also with Angela Rayner exercising her right to buy and going, you know, who wouldn't have done what I young? I had that opportunity to buy our council flat, which was a beautiful flat, and I didn't. I moved out once I started making some money, and once the right to buy came, I moved out and let some other more needy person have it. You know, just because she had the right to buy her bleeding council house doesn't mean she should have. She was right to, you know, exercise it. Sometimes she gets a bit of a free pass, but I think that kind of thinking indicates she's as corrupt as the rest of them. Just an aside there.
It's been a profound time for me since, you know, around this book thing, man. It's been wild having to. So this is about a year ago, Ben approached my family about accessing Dad's writings, doing his research for this book. I haven't been able to talk about it on this podcast, but, you know, that kind of forced me to kind of go through the rabbit hole of reading all my dad's writings, you know, posthumously. Write in, listener.
Posthumously.
Posthumously. Posthumously. That was quite an emotional experience. And then the book launch was really amazing. And then, that's the first time I've bloody cried on the podcast. Can you think, in all these years, you haven't managed to make me cry yet, Alexei?
Oh, well.
All your cruelty and harsh words.
I cry all the time these days, so I don't know if I've done it on the podcast or not, but I certainly did it last night at the MAP when I was speaking, for example.
Fuck.
Yeah. Well, you think you're going to be all right, and then one up it gets you. And how's the experience been then of had this book coming out, being serialized on Radio 4 and
I find
all that?
His summary of my, because, you know, my dad had done a lot in his life, and Ben's summary of my, when Ben, like I said in the interview, he introduces each character with like a long passage about summarizing their life. And when my dad died, there were a few obituaries in various papers and stuff for him. And none of them did half the work that Ben did in his research. And like I say also in the interview, Dad was never really like a proud guy, but I felt, and he died in lockdown. So you were there at his funeral. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, we barely had a funeral.
Yeah.
A wake. Yeah. We just had some people around our house.
Yeah.
We weren't able to do an event, do a fucking rent a hall out or whatever, or even a pub or anything. And Dad had touched so many lives, had been around the block, and had done so much valuable work, including stuff for Palestine. He worked at UNRWA for a while. And we didn't really get to give him the send-off he deserved.
Right.
And that was kind of just a consequence of the times we were living in. Yeah. It was summer of 2020. So that's like peak lockdown time, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's almost like this is kind of, even though it's pinned around one event and no one can be defined by one event in their life, this is still kind of, it's kind of giving him, it's like having a statue built for someone or something, you know, right. He's been immortalized in this book.
And it's been announced that the team that made the show Slow Horses are going to make a TV show of this.
Of the siege.
Yeah.
And the other film that got made of the siege is so dog shit, and they didn't really do the hostages justice, whereas I have a bit more faith in this one. I'm hoping I might
that
even...
wasn't the Lewis, Who Dares Wins, the Lewis
No,
Collins
it was called or... 6 Days.
I don't remember. And they didn't remember it.
It starred that little blonde kid who played Tintin in the Spielberg movie. But it was all about the SAS, and it was all very, it was army propaganda. It was horrible, and it was nothing to do with the hostages. And they even changed my dad's name in the film to Karkuri so that they could get away with, you know.
Right.
They never even contacted the family about it and stuff. Right. so I feel like, this is nice for me. And I know a lot of people don't get that opportunity. Some people die in obscurity and they don't get the send off they ever deserve. And I'm lucky that my dad's name is going to get a mention in this book.
Yeah.
And I appreciate my privilege. But it's still nice that after having such a quiet death and funeral, we were at the book launch. Ben did a presentation. It was like my dad's face was up on the screen, and he spent a few minutes describing my dad's involvement in the story. It's just nice. It's just a very nice feeling, albeit a strong reminder of one of the more traumatic period times in his life. You know, it's wild, but it's surreal also. It's very similar.
I mean, obviously a few people kind of had his experience or your experience of, So do we want to just end on a depressing, you know?
Oh, you could get more depressing. Anything you want to get off your chest?
I don't know. Really. I mean, just shit keeps going on and on and on, doesn't it, really? And, nothing seems to change. Did you go on the demo on Saturday? The other Saturday, I did. I thought it was a big one, and also it was very uplifting. Really, it was. Also, I noticed that I don't know whether it was significant, but the little crowd of Zionist shitbags who gather at the Old Witch had considerably shrunk. I don't know whether they're ashamed to show their faces or whatever. There's only about 30 of them there.
Yeah, it's embarrassing for them.
Yeah,
biggest protest. Yeah, I was very proud to be able to be part of it. But again, like part of me feels like, you know, they allow us to do these protests. They allow us to make our posts on Instagram. But no one seems to be budging on the, in terms of people in power.
No.
And it's like Iraq all over again. Like, you know, was it 2001? A million people marched?
2003,
excuse me. A million people marched?
Well, 30 million people marched across the world on that one day.
Mm-hmm.
And they took fuck all notice, well, that's why one way or other we have to seize control of the levers of power, I'm
precisely
afraid.
Short of a revolution, I don't see
you
change.
Get arrested now if you advocate violent revolution.
I never said violent.
No, I'm just on me, really.
The question.
Because you get, if you say anything positive.
Sure, you can. I bet you can.
Hamas.
Speak about MI5. Yeah, sure. Of course they can arrest us. Yeah. So that's why we're not going to advocate violence.
No, we're not.
uprising on our podcast.
Seize the telephone. I don't know what you would do really with that. You know, the template used to be you would seize the telex office and the telephone exchange and the radio station. I don't know what the modern equivalent of that would be for an armed uprising. Seize Nando's.
But if only there was a way to like hold the government hostage in a way, but not violently, but like threaten them with something. Oh yeah, obviously, fucking general strike.
Yeah, well, people do say
that's exactly it, isn't it? How to hold them hostage syndicalism. Without violence.
Yes, that's one way. I'm always a bit leery of that, but certainly the independent, there are laborers obviously at the moment. I suppose we shouldn't necessarily take too much, but Labour is vastly unpopular. Starmer himself, the little shit, is the most unpopular PM of all time, I think. There is a space perhaps for those independents, Jeremy and the other four, and there is a space. You know, there are more independents in Parliament than there ever been before. A movement. They are talking to each other, I know, and they need to.
Yeah,
that movement needs to coalesce to place a voice.
Yeah,
which by and large, I think left ideas. You know, as we've said, Jeremy was defeated in the 2019 general election, which was supposed to be a catastrophe, and he had 500,000 more votes than Starmer got with this massive success. I mean, how do you explain that? So Jeremy's ideas are and were popular, and we need to find out. You know, if we're going to, you know, like you need to find a way to make that.
Well, Jeremy failed.
Into power.
Jeremy failed because of the failure of, because of the success of his opposition, whereas Keir succeeded because of the failure of his opposition.
Yes, because the Tories had collapsed, yeah.
That's why his victory was so weak.
Yeah,
And probably why he excluded, forced these players to become independent and leave the Labour Party.
I don't know why those seven MPs that are suspended at the moment to stay in the fucking Labour Party.
What are they holding on to, But that prevents them from challenging his leadership.
Yeah.
From having them not in the party.
Yeah.
Dastardly little prick.
Yeah.
Slimy, squeaky bastard.
He is an awful, awful, awful man. Although, as I've seen in The Guardian today, it was pointing out that Thatcher was at a similar low point in her career. And, of course, what revived her was the... Oh, wait, Wilf.
It's been a while, Wilf.
Yeah. Well, I think all cats are Thatcherites, really. Maybe he's making a case for neoliberalism. Hayek and the road to serfdom. Thatcher's low point. And what revived her career popularity was the Falklands War, so... Starmer will be looking for his own Falklands War, presumably.
Fuck off.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Is that enough for now? Is this what people want?
Now that Wilf's had his say, I think people are happy now. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Yeah, back soon, yeah?
A Museum of Comedy. Museum of Comedy. Yeah, 5 nights of... fun and improvisation and new material, all new material. Museum of Comedy, Museum of Comedy, Museum of Comedy.
Link 16th, is in the podcast description or go to museumofcomedy.com.
Yeah. Chance to see me working live, which is very rare these days. Don't miss it. All right.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.